Welcome to the Family Express podcast, where our destination is resilient and connected families. Come aboard with your hosts, marriage and family therapists, Catherine DeBruin and Rhonda Evans, to explore the world of emotionally focused family therapy, a model developed by Sue Johnson and colleagues. Together with our guest speakers, our travels will map the EFFT landscape, highlighting lessons learned, shared fears, and the passion and curiosity that bonds our community.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Family Express with Catherine and Rhonda. And today is the next installment of our Attachment in Action series, and we're going to be tackling the preschool years, aren't we, Catherine?
Yes, let's talk about preschool. So I'm thinking 3 years old, 4 years old, and Rhonda, as I was reflecting on, we've been talking about infancy, then we talked about toddlerhood, and I was trying to think, okay, what's really different about 3 and 4? So with babies, I'm thinking, oh man, that baby is just lying in someone's arms, okay? It's just about being cozy, being alive, and growing. And then you've got little toddlers who are learning how to be mobile. So they're learning how to walk and talk, and suddenly their world is a whole lot bigger, like so much bigger. And so they're just managing that big new world, which with it brings incredible exploration opportunities and also massive amounts of anxiety. Okay. And parents, of course, who have to make their house really safe for the environment. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now you've got preschoolers, I think, who are used to this bigger world a bit more. They're already able to be mobile and they have some language. And so what's additional for the preschoolers is that they are perceiving, they are absorbing tons of information about the emotional system. They can feel stuff. They know what's happening in their environment. And the question is, can the parents and caregivers help the preschooler take this information they're perceiving and put it through their little intellectual system into language and stories that make sense?
Hmm.
Or will the child perceive stuff and then left to their own limited little brains come up with all kinds of distorted understandings of what's going on and why as they match what they're feeling and what they're seeing in their
life? Yeah, I'm just already having flashbacks to my kiddo when he was in the preschool years and there was some distortion that was happening, wasn't there?
Do you have an example of that? Or
no, it's just a general vague feeling inside of me, Catherine.
Okay.
The other
thing that is that preschoolers are absolutist. And so their thinking is like super simplistic and super black and white.
Yep.
And the most annoying part for me about preschool was that my kids went to school and loved it and loved their teachers and wanted to do everything just right. And so then preschool has a lot of things in the States, like Friday's Blue Day, and then next week is Spirit Week, and then you got to wear this T-shirt and that T-shirt. And when you're two working parents and you got three kids in different schools and different classrooms, that stuff, there was just so much to try to
track.
I mean, I loved all the fun stuff, but man, it was a lot to get right. And the problem is, as a parent, if you're not getting that right, then sending your kid in the blue outfit on Blue Day, like, what does it mean to your child, right? So what irritated me the most is that I would get the piece of paper and I felt like I was tracking these days correctly because I knew it was important. But then I would say to my child, okay, honey, Friday's Blue Day. And then my kid thought the teacher said, no, Friday's Pink Day. And lo and behold, if we had an argument, I'm like, no, I know it's Blue Day. It says on this piece of paper, it's Blue Day. And they're like, no, my teacher says it's Pink Day. What's teacher more important than me? And so I would literally have to like negotiate with them.
Yeah.
And then, look here. Here's me texting the other parents. Here's me texting the teacher. Here's the teacher who replied, it's blue. And only then would they believe me. So they're like, this is absolutist. Oh, if the teacher said this, this is all truth, you know?
Right, right, right. That's such a hard, I'm just remembering my son doing that as well, and it, all different kinds of things. And I, you know, I, for me, I got to be honest, he tended to remember better than I did.
As long as you knew that, right? Then you could just follow along. But I think what you're saying there is, like, there's a tendency at this age to get into negotiating.
Mm-hmm.
And it's actually incredibly important.
Yes.
Because kids are developing negotiation skills.
Yes.
Learning about different perspectives, how to balance conflicting needs. And that's a big part of their learning.
Mm-hmm.
It can go too far in a direction of there just being conflicts about everything. Mm-hmm. But it can also be on the other side where it's just authoritarian parents, where the parents decide everything and kids are taught to be obedient and respectful and not question. Mm-hmm. So you have this continuum, right? But it's really helpful for me to know that for preschoolers, as they're learning language and intellect, if they can have a little bit of a say or some talking and they can put stuff into words and understand things, it really is the time of negotiating, because they're negotiating how the world works. And they're going to do that through the parent-dyad relationship.
Totally. Yeah. Yeah. No, it just, I just love that valuing negotiation, putting a value, a positive value on negotiation, one for the dyadic interaction and what that attachment wise says, message you get, you know, it sends to the kid. But also, you know, language and more elaborate language. And if we use a more elaborate language, then the kid gets exposed to that. And yeah, I can just see how there are certain families where there might not be as much value on that. And they probably have good reasons in their family, right, for doing it differently. But I do think it is a different perspective to put value on that negotiation in the dyadic interaction.
It really blew my mind when I heard this perspective, because I was raised in a pretty authoritarian kind of country and household. And so I do feel like we were brought up to just be more, you respect the elders and you don't question. Questioning was considered disrespectful, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then I remember being around a previous boss of mine, and she was raising her two girls in this phase, and she was negotiating with them. And so she had an example of wanting them, you know, to eat their dinner, and on their dinner plate there were, you know, 5 peas and 3 carrots, etc. And the kids didn't really want to eat, and she wanted them to eat.
Mm-hmm.
And so it could have turned out to be about a power struggle. If that was my household, I would have sat at the table for 5 hours until I ate the food.
Mm-hmm.
But her household, she negotiated with these little girls and said, okay, so you don't want to eat the 10 things on your plate. Mommy wants you to eat them. How about we do 5 and you can pick which 5? And then next thing is her kids were eating the 5 things.
Mm.
And I was like, wow, that's so different. And
that's so different.
So now they're learning math. They're learning negotiation. Right. Maintaining their relationship. And everyone walks away with not everything they wanted, but with something.
With something.
A totally different way to think. You know?
And with something that is, how do you say this? Everyone's walking away with something, and it's not just a power struggle. They don't walk away with just a power struggle memory.
Ooh, can you? Okay, so let's go. Yeah. The power struggle, you've got a parent who's disappointed and mad, mm-hmm. pushing and frustrated. You've got a child who feels terrible, who's then sitting there maybe for hours with those horrible feelings. And there's no talking about it or understanding what just happened, or everyone actually feels terrible on their own. and it affects the relationship, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, if I put myself in the shoes of a little kid sitting at a table for hours and hours, all those negative feelings and no one's talking about it and everyone's feeling horrible, then my brain goes to like, well, then that poor kid is just sitting with negative feelings all on their own and isn't getting any help with those negative feelings. It's almost as if the negative feelings aren't seen, aren't acknowledged.
The parents don't feel like successful, right? And or maybe frustrated. And
they're not doing what I'm telling them to do.
I know
that they aren't doing it.
Mm-hmm. And then how does that affect one's relationship with food, right? That's another whole other thing
for sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So as we're reading this chapter together, Rhonda, Dr. Crittenden and her peers give a really nice example. Should we talk through this example and then talk about like three different ways to respond as a parent?
Yeah.
And talk a little bit about what the implications could be as a result of how the parents responded.
Yeah, let's do it. I think that would be really, really helpful.
Okay.
How about I kind of read the little story?
Oh, yeah, thank you.
I won't read all of it. I'll kind of paraphrase it a bit. In our scenario, we'll use mom because that's what the book is. It'll be easier for me. In the scenario, mom is ready to go and little Johnny is not ready. He calls back just a minute and then promptly forgets her, concentrating on the Lego he is building. She waits a short minute and calls again and he grunts. And what we have here is a dilemma of conflicting plans and priorities all of a sudden between the dyad. So Johnny's mom comes over to him. She admires his construction and explains to him what he's doing and listens to his explanation of what he's doing. She repeats his plan so that he knows she understands and he hears it back to him in elaborate language. And then she explains her idea of the plan. In this particular example, they have to account for little sister. They have to account for dad coming home. And everyone in the family is accounted for. In this case, Johnny's going to not kind of get the negotiation he wants. He'll actually have to bend to the needs of the others in the family. But how will mom facilitate that without having to impose her will? And so here is what mom says.
Rhonda, can we just slow down for a second?
Yeah, let's do it. Yeah.
Okay. So the scenario is that little Johnny sitting at a table playing Legos.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Mom needs to go out to the store, mm-hmm. right? There's other people in the family to consider.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so classic example in any of our households, really.
Totally.
I think this is so true that families have conflicting needs. Like all the time,
never ends.
Word, like not to mention our needs, right?
Yeah. What are those again?
So mom has to go to the store. We got to get dinner on the table. And Johnny, if it were up to him, he would just play Lego.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you handle a situation like that? So she might say, hey, let's go to the store, everybody. Let's go, jump in the car. And he's like, no, I want to play Lego.
Mm-hmm.
Typical, okay? Okay, so you're saying, let's talk about three ways to handle that as a parent.
Mm-hmm. I think I've probably done all three, by the way. I think I played around with all three types of responses. So,
oh, my word. Yeah, I think so. I do probably too. Should we? Okay, I want to do the authoritarian one. Can I do that one?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, so let's go with a household where it's just like top down. Authoritarian parent. And in that moment, so I would say to Johnny, get up right now. Did you hear what I told you to do? Get in that car. I'm counting to three. Go. Okay. So some version of that. Okay.
Right.
All right. What do you think the effect is on a 3 or 4 year old Johnny if I respond that way?
Well, I don't matter. I mean, that's what comes up first off is anything that I want doesn't matter. And
that's going to feel bad.
that's going to feel bad, you know, and I might have some feelings about that. I might get angry or I might cry. It doesn't really, either way, getting out the door quickly is probably not going to happen because I'm little Johnny's going to have some feelings about that.
Could backfire.
Could backfire. And as far as the language piece, little Johnny, negotiation is not valued, right, in that authoritarian system. Yeah. And so Johnny doesn't get the permission to practice language on his side, learn to express wants and needs. It's just not valued. It's just top down, whatever the parent is requiring at the moment.
And he doesn't learn that there's lots of needs in this family. And here's what we have to consider. There's other people's perspectives. And so he maybe just learns, I'm not important. Don't have a voice. Keep your feelings to yourself, and the world is full of power and control type of relationships.
Exactly. Yeah, it was really eye-opening, just the one sentence from the chapter in the book where it says that the kid will learn that relationships are about power and submission. And honestly, that one sentence just kind of broke my heart. And people don't learn this interpersonal conflict resolution, really. I mean, we're talking about a building block for interpersonal conflict resolution down the road, which, by the way, will be very important on the playground in elementary school. So we should give them some reps when they're taught in our house.
Yeah. When we can.
When we can, yeah. When it's safer, when it's just us, right? Like, what a great time to give them safe reps of that negotiation skill.
Okay, so that's the authoritarian type of a response. Let's go completely the other extreme.
Okay.
And I can easily fall into this one, which is more of a, what do you call it, like permissive.
Crittenden calls it permissive, also enmeshed.
Enmeshed, permissive type of parenting. Okay. So and I feel this a lot as mom, in that moment, it's like you really don't want to be authoritarian. You want your child to have a voice. You want to consider their feelings, but you've also got a lot of different things to consider. And in that moment, I feel sort of helpless, a bit powerless. Like I'm not going to be able to meet three kids' needs at the same time. And I'm unsure what to do.
Mm-hmm.
And, or I'm like so busy that I don't want to have a power issue. I don't want to have conflict right now. So right. I actually just give in and make it easier. And so in a moment like that, I could just make my plans go away and not go to the store and then have dinner laid on the table because I don't want to upset him.
Right.
Or I could actually like go and over respond. Oh, honey, of course you want to stay. Oh, that feels bad. You're using your voice. That's amazing. Actually kind of like heighten that response, right?
Yeah.
And then almost look to him and be like, what do you think we should do?
Right. You make the decision because I don't want you to feel bad. I want to save you from feeling bad.
Mm-hmm. And like hope to everything that maybe he'll just come along with us anyway. Or maybe I would totally do this. I would bribe him or something. I would totally do that. Okay. What's problematic with that? What could that possibly lead to?
Well, I think it puts a lot of, I'm playing around with the word of power. Like it puts a lot of power in the kid's hands, but I think it definitely, so many repetitions of that type of interaction, I think the kid does learn that they're kind of in charge in this house, you know, that what they want is going to fly, is going to go, and they can kind of do whatever reaction they do to kind of get what they want. Yeah. And the term spoiled brat comes to mind. That's maybe an old term that I used to from a while back.
Yeah, they're going to look like that at the
surface. They're going to look like that on the surface.
They get used to having a lot of control.
Yeah.
The bigger the meltdown, the more control they get.
Mm-hmm.
But you're right. Like what's under the surface of the spoiled brat is actually a child who doesn't feel very secure at all. Because the weight of that decision on that kiddo, who, yes, they're happy that they got their way.
Sure.
What they also are not getting is a structure. a hierarchy that makes sense, which actually helps them feel safe and secure. So they what they're not learning is, here's how the world works. In our family, these are the rules. Mommy makes the decisions. I can follow along. I can rest in that. And so it's actually like that decision weighing on their limited brain cognitively is actually, it's too weighty for them. And mm-hmm. I think it impacts them and they actually on some level don't feel good.
Yeah.
And now they kind of feel good, but they don't feel good. Things don't make sense. And it's too much for a child to handle, I think. Not enough structure, not enough security top down.
Yeah. Yeah. I get the image of like the fence around the house or like guardrails. And I don't know, I mean, how many kids I worked with back in the day. I don't work with them as much anymore. And the kids, whether it was a two-parent household or whether the parents were separated or divorced, it really didn't matter. But I don't know how many kids told me, I like being with the parent who has a routine, who has structure, has expectations that I do my homework and that I do this chore. They actually liked that household better. Mm. I don't know how many kids I had tell me that.
Mm.
And in the households or the alone time with the parent, where those limits or guardrails, whatever you want to refer to them as, just weren't there. It was like, whatever the kid wants to do, go ahead and do it. They did not really prefer that.
There's something you're saying, which is, are things consistent in my world and predictable?
Mm.
And with permissive parenting, it's like anything can go at any time.
Mm-hmm.
So there's so much flexibility, but it's just too much, right? It's
too much flexibility. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Just this idea of like, it's this, the sentence that really was kind of something kind of for a mind spin was, the kid both feels in charge and overlooked. And I just thought that was kind of like mind bending in a way. Just there is no kind of external locus of authority coming from the parent or the caregiver. It was so flexible, so open that the kid feels like I'm not seen enough or I don't matter enough to be for someone to kind of put this time and effort and energy to put the guardrails around. It's just so permissive.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Okay, so wow, so we've got some extremes here.
Right.
Oh, so what would the idyllic, of course that never really exists, but what are we have to have a goal. What are we going for in terms of Johnny's mom? How could she respond?
So I just keep learning from this book. It's been so good to read it. That the way Johnny's mom responds is bending, kind of kneeling down next to him. And I love how they like first commenting on the Lego that he's building, right? Like noticing him, his desire to be kind of seen in this creativity, this building. So she's commenting on, oh, I see what you've built. Look at what you've constructed. This looks so great. I know you want to keep playing. And we also have things we need to do for the family. And so then mom goes through in a more elaborate language describing to Johnny, we got to think about your sister who is going to come home from school. We got to think about daddy coming home from work. We got to think about all of us wanting to eat and not being, overly hungry. And I'm just starting dinner and everyone's cranky because they're so hungry. And to think about all the other people, mommy has a plan that we need to look at doing. And so I just love this engaging Johnny in negotiation, thinking about other people, and he's not always going to get what he wants. And then she says, and when we get back from the grocery store, you can go back to playing with your Lego. Maybe I can have some time to sit down with you. So he's still getting acknowledgement around what he wants, and he does still get that while in negotiation, learning to take the different perspectives of other people outside of himself.
Yo, that's a lot of learning right there. Hey, so mom enters his little world, honey, Of course you want to keep doing Lego. I would want it too. Who doesn't want to? Wow, let's look at your Lego. And so she validates him emotionally in his plan. Then she says, however, here's what we need to do as a family, and here's why. And then she makes a plan of, like, let's close the door, we'll come back. And she also offers, like, a little incentive, and we can, you know, maybe your Lego will be finished when daddy gets home or something. And then she says, and now let's go.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So it's kind of like, it's short and sweet, but it's emotionally attuned. It's not elaborate. She makes the decision. She moves along. She redirects something else to focus on. That's a lot of potential for learning negotiation, language skills, the storyline, while staying connected emotionally to where he is and his development needs.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I just think it's like really interesting how, you know, I'll use a phrase and I'll use it intentionally. In this particular case, mom still, quote, wins, right? Like mom's plan still executes. Mom's plan still happens. It's just how mom goes about describing the plan, approaching the plan. It's not this like top-down authoritarian way. Do this and have no explanation. Don't try to understand why. It's just do it because I say, right? Like it's not that the outcome still ends up being the parent is the one with the authority. The kid understands that, but it's like a, how would you describe it? It's almost like parent with authority with the child in mind, like the best interest of the child. Yes. Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. It takes more time.
Totally does.
And it involves this education and emotion coaching. But what the mom is doing is still getting her way, but doing it through the child's developmental and emotional language needs.
Totally.
Right. And I think you can only do that if you understand where the child is at and what the next developmental step is, then one can break it down in that sequential way.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I remember when I was parenting my babies and trying to do some of that type of reflection and language stuff. And I remember people saying to me, why are you talking to your children like they're adults? You know, I mean, it was, and I remember parents who did that, and I loved the way they did that. But definitely for my family and generational system, it was very weird.
It was noticeably different.
It was very, very different. And they thought I was just being a psychologist and
therapizing your kid.
Yeah, like just too much, like talking to your kids like they're adults.
Interesting. Anyway. What a difference, huh? What a difference in.
But if I'd known what I know now, I could say, "Well,
these five. Let me show you all the great things I just did as a parent."
So let's talk about one more thing, which is, you know, right now we're getting very insular in terms of who the child is developmentally, and then sort of the inside of the family home. But something that, and I love that we're thinking family systems, right? But there's another whole massive step to go beyond that, which is that we need to also understand what's happening in the family community, culture, and environment. We have to consider the context.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
we do. When we're thinking about how these kiddos might show up in our offices, these families show up in our offices, we can't look at these patterns and direct treatment planning if we haven't considered generational influences and the larger context of the family. Because otherwise, we're not going to understand the kind of parenting that's been set up and why that might be really functional and important. Mm-hmm. So we never want to start dismantling something until we understand how it has been important for this family system. Yeah. Even though it might be breaking down now, right?
Yeah, exactly. Just this idea that, if you want to call it a style or a strategy, that whatever way the parents or the caregivers, whatever strategy they chose, most likely made sense in the context of when and where they were raising that kid. I just think about the, you know, wars and civil wars that are happening, or wars between countries and war-torn countries, and or living in refugee camps, and you're just, as a parent, you're just trying to keep your kids safe. And that, to do that, that is the most important job, right? It's the most important thing. And to do that, that authoritarian style works really well for helping kids be compliant and follow the rules. And that would make a lot of sense.
There's a beautiful quote here in the book. Well, I'm going to quote the book. The writers say, when a family or a culture has faced extreme life-threatening threat, obedience to the rules that minimize the threat become more important than teaching children self-expression and negotiation.
Mm.
Right? Here we are talking about raising emotionally mature, emotionally intelligent children with self-expression and negotiation. That's a privilege, right?
Totally.
That's when families can think in this way because they feel safe in the external world.
Yeah. And also the parents aren't in survival mode themselves, right? Their own nervous systems aren't, you know, they're, for a parent who's in survival mode and whose nervous systems are on such high alert, teaching self-expression and negotiation isn't
a priority. It's not the most important thing right then. It's no. Survival. Right?
So and it's not maybe even accessible to the parent, right? Like, that may not be accessible to the parent to be able to do this type of strategy. And I just love it when you say it's a privilege, because I think you got to be pretty comfortable and feeling pretty safe to be able to have this other kind of strategy.
Right.
And I just think we need to acknowledge and understand that the strategy makes sense in the context of when and where the kid is being raised.
Like, I think of clients who've come through my office, and where I hear this often is with immigrants
mm-hmm.
who are coming to the country, and they're just trying to make it here, right? They're just trying to understand. There's so much effort to learn a new language and understand how things work, and to try to just fit in.
Mm-hmm.
That's really where their energy and resources going.
Yeah,
or parents. Maybe single parents who are just trying to make it economically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right?
They're working multiple jobs.
Yeah.
That's what's most important is just, can we make it economically through the month?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Which is a certain type of survival mode, right? I mean,
there's also kids who need to be raised to be able to stay alive. Mm. Out in society and on the streets, like kids who are marginalized.
Mm-hmm.
And like, I think of racial discrimination.
Mm-hmm.
To mm-hmm. teach children what that is and how to look out for that and how to protect yourself. And like, those are additional big life lessons that the learning is going towards.
Yeah. And the energy has to go to those. Right. The energy has to go to that type of teaching and that type of learning, because in those contexts, that's most important. Self-expression, mm-hmm. negotiating and saying what you want. Not the most important lesson for some kids.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so when we get a child like this in treatment, it's just so important for us to get to know the family system, make sure that we're talking, if there's two parents or more. Make sure that you're talking to all those parents, right?
Yeah.
Even if one of them is off working all the time and can't get to session, we have to consider their perspective, mm-hmm. because we could start setting up, like talking to a parent about, feeling expression and
right.
Your father voice. But we want to consider, is that going to be supported by all the parents involved?
By all the adults. Mm-hmm.
And if this is a three-generational household, does the generation above that understand that? And mm-hmm. is that going to set up more potential for conflict or or less, right? And so, yeah, just important to do.
Yeah, which I think you're part of what you're talking about is, you know, buy-in, right? Like, are we getting buy-in from the parents, from the adults?
Whoever's
involved in the treatment. Mm-hmm. And we have to make a really good, really good effort to reach out to the adults, to the other caregivers and involve them. I think building that alliance and understanding what are the needs of the family, the context of the family, so that we are getting really clear on like context appropriate, culturally appropriate goals and needs. And if we have an agenda and we think families should look a certain way, we kind of need to check ourselves on that and remind ourselves that the client, the family is the expert on what's best for them and see if we can maybe negotiate or look at, you know, between us and the family, you know, what are they wanting help for and how can we help them?
Yeah. Well, it's been fun to talk through the preschool years.
Yeah. 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 I just love the examples that Crittenden gives. They're so simple and yet they just exemplify so much.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. I think we're looking at our next episode, which won't be out for a while because we do have some guest speakers coming back for the upcoming episodes, is 4 to 5 year olds, according to the book. And it's a long chapter, Catherine. So buckle up.
All right. Listen. Look forward to seeing you next time. Thank
you. All right. Sounds good. Ciao.
That's it for today, folks. Thank you for listening. And we hope to see you again for our next journey.